Apúrate que se acaban las ofertas de Early Black Friday en Lowe's. Ahorra hasta 50% en electrodomésticos selectos y hasta 25% extra en combos de electrodomésticos selectos. Y como la Navidad ya se siente, ahorra $4 en luces LED de 100 bombillas en hilera GE. Ahora solo $5.98. Lowe's, nosotros ayudamos, tú ahorras. Válido hasta 12-3, selección varía por tienda, solo en tiendas selectas, hasta agotar existencias. Detalles en Lowe's.com.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. We return to a whole raft of weird tales as author and researcher Kevin J. Gould returns with a second volume of American Strangeness. From dragons attacking trains to the birth of the haunted automobile, a myriad of women in black stories, some rather crap hoaxes, and much, much more, the book is chock full of wonderful and weird stories. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes too. Thank you to each and every one of you for your contributions and support. It means a great deal. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his art, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. The Fortean has always been experienced and reported upon, and Kevin J. Gould shares some of these wonderfully lost weird tales from the past. In his first volume of American Strangeness, author and researcher Kevin J. Gould chased down a myriad of odd encounters for our pleasure. Now, in a bumper-packed sequel, we've train-attacking dragons. Perhaps some of the earliest accounts of ghostly automobiles being encountered on American roads, ghostly ladies in black, and the forgotten stories of the Gown Man. Kevin, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hi, Paul. It's a pleasure to be back here with you.
Absolutely delighted. Absolutely delighted. It's always good when I really love a book and then the sequel comes along less than a year later and, in my opinion, is even better than the first book, Kevin.
Thank you. Sequels tend to disappoint, so I'm thrilled to hear that.
This is definitely your Aliens, I think, Kevin.
I feel good about both of them, but this one, there are some themes running through that really intrigued me, and I think hopefully that came across.
I suppose when you're building on the great work of the first book, Kevin, and obviously the work that you'd done in regards to the Thunderbird photo and that kind of essential aspect of modern cryptozoology, the mystery that puzzles us all, that are convinced that we are people who have witnessed and seen that photo. Was it difficult for you to kind of go into a different direction in regards to some of the subjects that you've tackled in this second book, or did you purposefully try and focus on different aspects of this?
There was certainly a desire to track down different stories. A lot of it is happenstance, whatever sort of I stumble across or I just decide to look up any given day. And, you know, it's, the process of discovery is part of the joy of the writing that I do. So I let it take me in those directions. As I'm sure we'll talk about, some of this was, you know, I was looking into one story and then I would see kind of an oblique reference to another. And then that becomes a whole rabbit hole to fall down like Alice.
Absolutely. Well, I think, as I said in the introduction, one of the things that struck me, I really enjoy stories about people having encounters with ghostly vehicles. And as you alluded to in the book, you talk about some of these fascinating automobile stories, and also the fact that perhaps they were built on the British tradition, perhaps, of the haunted hearse or the carriage and horse-drawn carriage that can often be seen. And there are many stories of certain locations around the area where people have encountered such things, and there are many a haunted location that claims to have such things. When I read that chapter, this is probably one of the most modern origin stories in the paranormal we can search for, because cars have probably only been around since the early days of the 20th century. They are everywhere these days, on every continent around the world, probably with the exception of Antarctica. Well, whilst I know there are vehicles there, you can't really call them cars, because that wouldn't last very long, I suspect. And it amazed me. It's one of those things that they just seem to have become part of the furniture in the paranormal world. It's just over 100 years since the car was available to buy. And reading this, you're talking within a decade, people have stories of ghostly cars or people using cars for nefarious means and almost elevating them to the level of mystery.
You know, I think that's what I've been noticing, and what really intrigues me is that any new technology, especially one we take for granted today, when it was first developed, it tended to quickly develop a set of superstitions and just, I guess, fear and anxiety around it that manifested in these really strange encounters. We, you know, in the car, you're right. We can, you know, the car is within very, you know, history that's been pretty diligently recorded. So there are many stories out there, as you said, about phantom automobiles. You know, some of them fall into the realm of suddenly there were these people that had access to these cars. They could just tear through your community and cause all kinds of a ruckus. But to the degree of there were also ghost stories associated with them, and it carries on. It's sort of inherited that mantle from previous forms of locomotion, like the horse-drawn carriage.
There is also a kind of romanticism to some of these stories, perhaps not connected with the phantom side of it, but as someone who's got a real interest in that kind of 1920s, 1930s American gangster, it was always the case that most of these guys who were on the run, people like Dillinger and his ilk, would always have some kind of souped-up Ford that they'd got. And by this time, you'd obviously already got chop shops, you know, making cars to order for gangsters that made them faster than the police cars that were after them. And so you can see how quickly certain cars could be elevated to legendary status with or without a paranormal driver behind the wheel, Kevin.
Yeah, you're right. I think car culture probably started the moment the car was invented. Mm. You know, it taps into that, you know, that need for speed and the freedom, I think, of the open road.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's always one of those things about, you know, the great adventure of traveling around America's highways these days. Route 66 is probably the most famous car journey I would imagine you can take in the US, because it's known all around the world. I've watched numerous documentaries by a variety of people, Kevin, on motorbikes, cars and all kinds of strange contraptions driving up and down it. And even as someone who would not consider themselves to know much about cars in the slightest, even I'm moved by seeing this journey and some of the magical things you can discover on it. So it just shows you that it obviously 100 years ago, it must have seemed like the first men on the moon to these guys.
Yeah, that exactly right. I mean, it's just everything in the 20th century just changed so quickly. And I mean, I can only imagine like what it was like for our grandparents to go from like the airplane to the space shuttle. You know, it's just mind-boggling. I guess you go about your daily lives and these things happen in the background, but it also affects you. You know, you if you don't have a car now, you're unless you're in a city with great public transportation, you're kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
With Uber, I guess. Well, do you currently have Uber in the UK? I heard that there's been some kind of pushback with them, or they're temporarily allowed.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that said, "Oh, I'm never going to use that, Kevin."
Yep.
And I use it every time I go out now.
It's so handy.
It is. It's ridiculous. It's everywhere. It's creeping around the United Kingdom. I know certain cities are yet to catch on, but most major cities in the UK, Uber is there, which is quite helpful, I think. But they even do Uber Eats here. So we have taxis and we have food deliveries here through Uber. Yeah. Whether it's the same people doing it, I'm not sure, but I don't care. As long as I get where I'm going and my food arrives when I want it, I'm happy.
Yeah, I think I get DoorDash as much as the mailman here. You
know? Yeah.
Seems like to them, probably.
So I suppose when you're looking at this, was it surprising how quickly paranormal car stories start in America?
That really struck me. Absolutely. You know, and I break them down in the book because there are like the gangsters and troublemakers aspect of Phantom automobiles. And some of them do have like sort of a sense of the odd to them. Like they were like these custom built cars. Like there was one called the Gray Ghost, you know, it was gray and it had a really powerful engine in the person driving it. I forget if that one was a woman or a man, but you know, like dressed in like a scarf and a hat and very like all gray, you know, just sort of tearing around the country. Right. And then, you know, you have these tales of like sightings of skeletons driving cars that crash into a tree and explode. And the only thing left was the cigarette the skeleton was smoking, which I thought was a lovely detail.
Which kind of goes against the health regulations in those days, because you know that was the era where people were told to smoke for and get them sort of up and moving. You know, are you feeling a bit under the weather? Have a Capstan Full Strength, sir.
I guess if you're dead already at that point, why not?
Well, exactly. You don't need to worry about it. And so it is odd that you've got these outliers like skeletons driving cars, where it becomes very quick that you get the kind of stories where it seems that nobody's driving the car. I mean, there are a couple of amazingly funny stories in there about kids taking cars for drives, which is something that still happens. I mean, obviously these days you can't seem to be on social media for too long before you'll see somebody's dog wrecking a car because they've knocked it off automatic. Because obviously in the States, a lot of cars are automatic, where it's a vast majority here are manual. So that's not something we get a lot of. But it seemed that very quickly the car with no driver seems to take over as the main paranormal encounter with automobiles in this era.
It was like early 20th century Knight Rider. You know, there was already in the 30s. There was already somebody had already rigged up a remote control car. And I don't mean a small one. I mean a full size car that they could drive around. So I imagine there were plenty of people who saw this driverless car buzzing around and were alarmed, didn't know what was actually happening, you know. So
I mean, it's an interesting aspect to all this as well, is that there was a real lawlessness to it, because there weren't any rules, there weren't any regulations. Speed limits didn't really come in until people started getting run over.
I don't think they had traffic lights for a while
either. I don't think we had traffic lights here in the UK till the 40s, I think.
Wow. Yeah.
Obviously, it started with people walking in front with a flag. People would just fall under them here because they just couldn't understand what was happening, Kevin. People would just stand there. They wouldn't know what to do. And then, but I was watching a program the other week, and they were talking about inventions that never really took off. And one of those in the 1930s was like a canvas sleeve that would appear as you hit somebody, and the sleeve would pick them up and carry them, so you wouldn't be ringing them over. And then it very quickly got pointed out that it didn't really matter if you catch them. If you ran somebody over at 50 miles an hour, you were probably carrying somebody who was dead or seriously injured.
Yeah, you're just dragging them.
You're just getting some gravel burn on that high impact injury that you've just given them. So I suppose it's quite funny looking back, but it was really dangerous. And so I suspect that one of the tenements of the ghost car story was probably the number of accidents that were occurring as well.
Oh yeah, I mean it was a new threat. It could be deadly. Some of those, I mean, a lot of those stories reflect that. There were, for example, a lot of the automobile companies they had test drivers that would go out and test these new models, and sometimes, you know, some of them died, and there were ghost stories about them, you know, associated with the road and still driving their cars.
I think one of the favorite ones you mentioned is this marvelous story called Death Strip,
yes,
which is one of those where you've got a very famous person in vicinity mm-hmm. to driving this car. He's a guy that's well known in the area, and he's yep. seen by friends who know him, people yep. who know
other
him.
Other drivers and like mechanics have said they had encounters with him after he died on the road. Mm.
Is it surprising that once again you get that kind of aspect to them very quickly as well, that people are saying, oh, well, it's such and such, because cars and drivers, there aren't many where you've got certain attachments. I know there are a few stories of people claiming to have been overtaken by James Dean after he died in his delightfully named little bastard Porsche,
right.
That has a whole history of what that went on to do, because that car, it seemed, couldn't stop killing people even after James Dean had died.
It was said to be cursed, for sure. Yep. I should have included that one in the book, now that you mentioned it, but I didn't. Rhyme 3.
Well, there you are. Yeah, absolutely. It's celebrity ghosts and their mm-hmm. cars. It's a whole new, it's a, probably, a, we'd best not say that. I'm sure somebody's planning that TV series as we speak, Kevin. So, I mean, did you have any that sort of gave you pause for thought? Because like I say, some of them you can kind of see that it might be a tall tale, you know, smoking skeletons crashing into a tree and bursting into flames and then vanishing, but then leaving the cigarette behind is probably a very good tall tale told round a campfire after a couple of drinks, one suspects. But like I say, mm-hmm. the Death Strip one seems to be one of those that really gets under people's skin, because it's a famous yeah. person.
Right. And it's, you know, and it's people speaking of somebody they were friends with. There's that personal element to it. There were a couple times, not always, necessarily always in this chapter, but there were a couple times in this book where I just discovered something that kind of gave me the willies a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, I would say that was, you know, that's one of them. Yeah, anytime. I think, you know, there are a lot of stories with people who they only give a first name or they don't, you know, it's just very generalized. But yeah, when there's a level of detail there like that, it makes you ponder.
Mm. The Phantom Hearse is a mysterious one.
Right. It comes and picks up people who have died on the died in car accidents. Yeah.
But it's only around Los Angeles, it would seem so far, Kevin, that you've been able to see that story. Is it one of those that you, once you begin to peel these onions in regards to the paranormal stories of this era, it'll be interesting to see if you can start to spot the same story told outside
oh, yeah.
a town in Wisconsin or over on the East Coast?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a bit strange for it to be in LA. And it's also in that period where you think, well, are hearses frightening people? Do people have a strange reaction to them? I mean, that's one of the other things, I suppose, that now and over here in the UK, you will occasionally see people who have a funeral with a horse-drawn hearse. And it's a big song and dance, and people like to walk behind it, and it's a real show of love for the departed. I would imagine people seeing a hearse for the first time in that kind of regard would have kind of put the willies up people, primarily because
yeah.
the coffin's a lot lower for a start. People can see it a lot clearer than perhaps in a hearse driven by horses.
Definitely. And I think also the element of what's always frightened me about cars is just, you know, suddenly your life can end going about your business, buying your groceries, you know. It's just this, you know, it's just you kind of take your life in your hands every time you go out there. And I have to think that there was probably that aspect to it. But also, yeah, that's a good point about seeing the powered hearse for the first time, you know, kind of creeping its way down the road, you know, had to make people, you know, shiver a bit.
Mm. You could look at the adjacent phenomenon, which would be how quickly you would come across stories of phantom motorcycles and motorbikes, because
yeah,
absolutely. One of the most famous in Britain is also attached to one of Britain's most famous heroes of the 20th century, which is Lawrence of Arabia.
Right.
Who sadly died whilst riding his motorbike. Two children ran in front of him near his home in Dorset. And he swerved to avoid them, crashed and was right. and died of his injuries. And I think within about 3 weeks, people began to hear the noise of this very peculiar and specific bike that Lawrence had. I'm trying to think if it was a Norton. It probably wasn't. But it had people could tell it was very distinctive. I can't remember the last time. I don't think anybody's reported it in sort of the last 30 or 40 years, Kevin. But that's one of the earliest examples, because that's the 1930s here.
And it makes you think, like, how long do these, like, energies or whatever they are last, right? You know, is it sort of like the movie Coco, like as long as people remember them, or they resonate with people, you know, or is it just a matter of time?
Absolutely. And would changing the road affect it? I mean, that's the other thing, because obviously one of the other aspects of the introduction of motor vehicles is that a lot of roads had to be changed to deal with it.
Right. So you would think that people would see these phantom vehicles like in the middle of like, you know, a walking path or something that used to be a road. You know, I mean, you hear stories about that, like with phantom brigades, like soldiers and stuff, you know, like marching through areas where they would have walked, even though now it's, you know, like something else. Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think when that one, there was another one here in the UK in London of a phantom bus.
Yes. I feel like it.
Which I think was during the 1940s, which was one of the earliest ghostly motor vehicle stories I've ever come across, and very distinctive, obviously, especially the way it was behaving drew attention to it. Is it one of those phenomena that you think most motor vehicles will eventually have some kind of phantom? And have you come across a phantom Greyhound bus story perhaps yet?
You know, it's funny that one of the, when I was a kid, Weekly World News was a fixture at the supermarket, right? And as a kid, you don't always understand that it's for laughs, right? So one of the stories that gave me chills, and I remember just being scared to watch The Honeymooners, because not long after Jackie Gleason died, they said that his ghost is Ralph Crampton, had been seen driving his bus, because he was a bus driver on the show. And with the rest of the deceased Honeymooners cast that weren't around it anymore, driving through the streets of New York. And I'm like, oh my, you know, so I had like this fear of like, I don't know, a phantom bus. So I forget what your question was, but yeah, that just took me back to childhood trauma there.
Well, we all know that the aliens would have come back for Jackie. Surely you wouldn't have left him to drive that bus, would they? I mean, but that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Oh, the story about Richard Nixon showing him the alien bodies. Yeah.
Yeah, one of those random celebrity stories. I still scratch my head when I hear it. Interview, I think it was his widow was the first person to talk about that.
Yes.
So
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah. I think I forget if she revealed it in a book or an interview, but that was that story came out years later. It makes you wonder. Mm.
Well, I've always loved, I mean, I personally think it's a load of stuff and nonsense, but the story of the Flying Dutchman, Kevin, obviously probably the most famous ghost ship on the high seas, is a wonderful story. I don't believe it at all. I did when I was like 7. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Now I'm very skeptical about it, but it just shows you that there is all kinds of aspects, and you only have to look probably at the most famous ghost airplane story, which is the flight of 401, the famous one that came down in the Everglades in the 70s, and everything that happened after that.
All the pieces being portioned off to other airplanes. Is that
and people appearing and saying these planes wouldn't crash as long as I'm on this, and then vanishing. I mean, quite how the stewardess is going to calm down seeing a ghost come out of a microwave oven, I think one of them was, telling them she's going to be all right. No, that's not going to calm me down, Kevin.
So I think, you know, in the end, I mean, I think no matter what the means of transportation is, it becomes connected with spiritual activity. You know, I don't know if the vehicular nature of it and the mobility of it gives it, I don't know if it's a more frightening aspect to it, or just, you know, a more modern aspect, at least for the, you know, for the time period when it's when cars are new or not, but it's definitely a new spin. And that's why I like to go back and see, like, oh, well, yeah, there were phantom carriages, and phantom carriages were quickly supplanted by phantom automobiles.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just the ghosts, they updated their transportation like we did. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's several cowboy stories about ghostly riders wandering around. And there's a famous story of the red ghost camel, which is high comedy, I think, more than anything.
It is. Is that the one with this? I forget if that's the one with that has a skeleton on it.
Yes,
back.
And they finally realized it was real because somebody took a shot at it and blew the skull off. And then they went, oh, what is this? And then obviously they found out it was some poor bugger that had died on a camel just running amok.
I was reading about that when I was writing the first book. I did that story about the giant skeleton in the desert.
Yes.
And that came up in my research too. So I've ever, but yeah, I think you're right. That, you know, there was some truth to that, you know. Why the body was on a camel? I think they were testing camels out to see if they would be a fit for, you know, the Western territories in the United States. I don't think it worked out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. I think they just abandoned them, didn't they? And thought, oh, well, it's one of the, I once watched a very weird documentary about camels that basically said they all used to live in the Arctic Circle before the ice age, and then as the weather changed, they basically just started moving south to get away with it. Now we consider them to be desert creatures, but that's not what they evolved as originally.
Interesting.
Which blew my mind. I was like, what?
There are echoes of that in when you go out west here. There were a lot of mining communities, and they used mules, donkeys a lot. And when those mines closed down, a lot of those donkeys, they were just released or they got away. So today you can be, I remember I was out there, like, I think it was in Arizona, and you're driving through sort of this unpopulated area, and suddenly you'll see like this donkey just at the side of the road, just staring at you. You know, like, and that, like, how did that get there? But they've been there for generations. That's their home.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's, I'm not sure if there's a collection of camels in Australia, that the same thing happened there, that gold prospectors were using them, Kevin, and just eventually got bored of them when the railways were invented. So I'm not sure if they're still out there, or maybe that's something I've read an urban myth about. But that seems to, it seems to be these early days of pioneers that they thought, oh, this looks like a desert, we need camels, and just imported them all.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which makes sense, really.
Aren't camels a little grumpier than horses? Or I don't know if their temperament plays into their use or not.
Having ridden one in the Sahara, Kevin, I can attest to them being very, very cheeky. Mine just kept biting the arse of every other camel on the ride for 2 hours, which I found quite hilarious. But obviously all the other camels didn't seem to be enjoying very much.
Unique personality.
Yes, he certainly had that about him. He was a very, very, very comfortable camel as well. It was great fun.
Hmm.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
I suppose one of the things that might surprise people about this book is the amount of dragon stories from North America that are not connected to Native American and First Nations people, Kevin. Obviously, one of the most famous ones is in your book. It's one of those that I'm always surprised when I see people in the Fortean realm stumble across it even today, because I think it's probably the most well-known of these particular cases outside of the ones that are a bit more cryptid, like Van Meter and the like. Mm-hmm. That the attack on the train in California is a hell of a story, primarily because they claim to have so many people who see this bloody thing.
Yeah, unlike some of the other tales, which were like two woodchoppers out in the way. I mean, this was supposedly all the passengers and crew of a train that then talked about it when they got back to the station. So it's like, it doesn't make any sense. What could it be? But it was very dramatic, you know, very, very cinematic, with, you know, this winged creature coming across the desert and getting into a battle with the people on the train who were firing their pistols out the window at it. And then the train clipped off a part of its tail and then it went into a rage. So, it's funny when I started looking into the Thunderbird photo, I was interviewing a lot of people, and I talked to one of the official historian for Tombstone, Arizona, and he mentioned, oh yeah, that story in the train. And it took me forever. I couldn't find it. Like, I'm thinking, is he misremembering or something? But no, I found it eventually in Illustrated Police News.
Yes.
Illustrated Police News. There was the UK version. What I didn't know until not that long ago was that there was also a United States version, which I don't, I think they just called it. I don't think there was any relation.
Just ripped them off.
I think they just, yeah, copyright be damned.
What are they going to do? Sail over here?
Yeah. And it's available in these, like, you can find it online. I believe it's the Library of Congress, but they have like entire volumes for a whole year and it's not searchable. It's just this massive document. And so, but it's so much fun going through there, and the illustrations jump out at you. I mean, there are plenty of sea serpents and, you know, and ghosts and things. But yeah, I'm going through that and boom, there it is. There's the dragon, a beautiful illustration of the dragon attacking the train. Mm. So I was so happy. So that enabled me to then go back and find the original article. And it's really a great tale and just fits this whole legacy of Wild West dragon tales.
It's certainly more believable than the two guys who claim to see a flying crocodile with eight legs or whatever they say. Yes, it was.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There were a lot.
that image in the book, the image in the book really made me laugh.
Well, I can say, you know, just because I'll usually, when I write these stories, I usually share some version of them online on Reddit or wherever. And you get to see what resonates with people. And that really, those stories, just people love them. And I guess, I don't think it was any different back then. I think, you know, the people reading the stories must have just had a great time with them, you know, and it brought out this mystery of the frontier, I guess, and then the strange creatures, sort of like the dragons on old world maps, you know, or, you know, the sea monsters, I mean, you know, painted in the far off seas.
Well, some would say they're out there still, Kevin. We just don't, we just haven't come. Having seen some of the things that are lurking at the bottom of the sea, I would not be surprised if there's some Leviathan of some description still waiting to be discovered down there for us all to be terrified of.
I went on a whale watch this summer, which I've never done before. And so I saw my first like whale in person, and it was a finback whale, which is the second largest after the blue
whale. Wow.
And it's so large that when it submerges, its tail doesn't come out, you know, so you're really only seeing its back, but they're curious about the boat, you know, so they tend to come around, and just even the little bit that you can see of this beautiful animal, you know, you can only imagine, sort of like, you know, the mystery and the curiosity that people on rickety old wooden boats had when they came across something, be it a whale or something else out there in the great open expanse.
Absolutely. Those old magical stories of sailors running across an island in the middle of nowhere, and they thank goodness we can stretch his legs and go for a walk and get off the sea. And then somebody says, oh, let's make a fire. And suddenly, as the fire ignites, the island starts to wobble, and they suddenly realize that it's actually the back of a giant sea monster that they've decided to sit on.
Phantom islands are another topic that enthralls me. I haven't written about it yet, but I've been collecting, sources about it. And there's a book about it I just picked up called Phantom Islands, which it's just this idea that there are these reports of these islands that were either spotted or visited, and then nobody could find them again, or, you know, or they appeared on maps. And, you know, some of those were just, you know, they might have been put there by map makers to sort of as a copyright tool. You know, if you copy this, I know you, I know you ripped off my map because it doesn't exist.
Well, yes, I suppose one of the most, going for the cliche of Atlantis, which I'm in the camp that thinks it was in the Mediterranean, and probably the Minoans were probably the origin story for that, because obviously where they live got blown up, I don't think there's much better origin stories, but even that, people still argue about it. It's certainly not in the middle of the Atlantic, like a lot of people used to think about 100 years ago. But obviously one of the most famous Phantom Islands is High Brazil, which is supposedly off the coast of Ireland, which people have been searching for 400 years now, Kevin.
Oh, like, so there have been reports of that. And I thought you were going to say San Borodon. That's what I read a lot about. But
yeah. And that's another one where people, like you've just said there, people think that cartographers just stuck it on there as a copyright thing. But people thought, hang on a minute, where is this island? So there was tons of explorers that have spent time trying to look for it. I think it's one of those, like the Bermuda Triangle. I think as we've got older and we've got the technological advances of mapping and scanning the Earth from above now, Kevin, I think the days of Phantom Islands may be behind us, but I hope not.
Well, it's obvious they're cloaked by by mascara.
Well, you could also suspect and put forward perhaps that some of these Phantom Islands were volcanoes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, lands, you know, they sink sometimes. So it's, I definitely think, you know, I'm sure there's truth, you know, buried in there among all those reports.
Absolutely. I mean, Krakatoa is a prime example, essentially obliterated near enough every aspect of it. And then 50 years ago, something just popped up above the sea and has kept growing ever since. And now we've got baby Krakatoa. On the site of the original one. So yeah. God knows what might happen there, Kevin. But I think there's certainly an aspect of that you can say, yeah, there's a chance that some of these might have been real in the past.
And you wonder if there was any kind of civilization on them, what was lost and so forth. So it's fun to read back in those old explorer accounts. Mm. And, you know, obviously there's some fantastical elements that appear in those. But I don't think my understanding anyway, is a lot of like the sailors and everything. It's like that was part of their worldview, you know, mermaids and sirens and everything. This was just part of what was out there. You know, it's like they didn't question.
No. So, yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating time. One of those that I think is long overdue, a sort of reevaluation of some of these tales, I think, Kevin.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
One of the other aspects I think that may be surprising, but seems to be another omnipresent character in the world of the strange, is the Lady in Black, Kevin. She's everywhere, really, isn't she? I would be amazed if there isn't a country, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, that doesn't have a famous Lady in Black story. Are you surprised how many there were even back then? Because some people might think it's a cliche, but it's clearly been something that's been around for a very long time for people.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in America, I mean, obviously reflects similar stories in Europe. But yeah, there were tales of these ladies dressed in mourning or widow's weeds, as they call them, mourning clothes, that would be seen, you know, strolling the streets late at night, their faces covered by veils, wearing these obscuring black dresses. The aspects, the reports that would kind of chill you a bit were that some reports would describe them as moving, so that like they would be walking, yet if you tried to follow them, you could never catch up to them. So it's not even like they were running, it's like they were existing in like a different a different time frame or something, they were said to be omens. I mentioned some of the stories I read about chilled me, and one of the ones took place in Carbondale, Pennsylvania, which was a mining town. Mm. And this was in the 1800s, and it was said that during when the Lady in Black would appear three times, it would signify some calamity. And in the newspaper articles, they tie it back to an onset of not the plague, but like a plague of they called it black fever, which it's hard to pinpoint exactly what that was, but it sounds like it might've been the type of meningitis. Mm. There was another incident where there was a mine cave in and several people died. So, and all these stories are being told in the context in these news reports of current sightings of this woman in black. People are seeing her throughout town. They're trying to catch up with her. They can't manage to do that. And she did appear three times. And the third time was in front of one of the mine entrances. And so I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, did it signify anything? And so I went forward through the newspapers, and only days later, the last place that it said she appeared, there was a mine collapse and one of the miners died. They said the way they described it, it sounds like he might've been a hemophiliac. He got, you know, his skin, you know, his body got punctured by the debris. There were articles detailing encounters throughout the United States, specifically more so in the northern part of the country. And even back then they wondered why is this seen everywhere?
Mm. Like, so you were able to tie her appearance down before this final accident came, because often people will I mean, Mothman is a prime example of this. Mm-hmm. Nobody at the time sees anything on the Silver Bridge because everybody's dealing with the horrendous disaster that's happened.
Collapsed.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's only later that the stories begin. I mean, famously, when they made the film The Mothman Prophecies, within about 6 months, that's when people started talking about him turning up at Chernobyl. So the stories don't predate the imagery appearing. And so one can be skeptical, perhaps, about the actual veracity of these encounters, because surely you would tell them about somebody else before someone else put that idea out there, Kevin. And I've never been able to locate a Ukrainian source prior to the film coming out that talks about Mothman. It's only afterwards, and it's not Ukrainians talking about it.
There's also there's Mothman, but there are also stories. What is it? The Big Black Bird of Chernobyl.
Yes.
I'm not sure if that's the same thing or if that's a separate entity.
I think it's difficult to kind of pull them apart. I think people have kind of meshed them together, and it's difficult to know which is which, or are people just changing it to pull it away from Mothman? But even so,
well, this is all there in old black and white. You know, it's. You know, when you if you go by, I mean, I list all the sources. Mm-hmm. Go by in this Carbondale in particular incident, there are, you know, these sightings were happening. It was also picked up in other newspapers, and perhaps I think it was the New York Sun. Those accounts, I sometimes there's a little bit of embellishment, but then you go back and you find the original local stories, and they're not that different. You know, they were at least being reported on. So, and they were talking, you know, and in those articles, it related back to these previous events. So, but then that was the end of the reporting on it. And then you see that, like, within, I think it was like 9 days or something like that, there was this, the ghost was indicated as last being seen was the exact mine where the collapse happened.
Mm.
You know, so it's like they couldn't, you know, it wasn't orchestrated. And when it happened, I didn't see any reference to someone saying, oh, yeah, the woman in black was seen here. It's just it happened. And unfortunately, this man died. And, you know, so again, you know, there are coincidences, but it raised the hairs on the back of my arms a little bit, for sure.
One of the ones I really like is the Greenville ghost.
Yes, and that's a different. So that's a different lady in black. That's a different type of lady in black. So most of the time, the lady in black, she can be spectral. She can just kind of benign. Sometimes they say she exists as a warning to men who are out thinking of philandering to go home to their wives. But this particular lady in black was a different type that you also see in a lot of places, which is most likely is described as most often being essentially a man dressed in these widow's clothes. You know, they might be 6 feet tall, muscular. They're, you know, anyone that tries to, you know, mess with them gets knocked to the ground. And the Greenville ghost, which is in Jersey City, New Jersey, appeared originally. We'll say she, because I had no idea. But the, you know, she appeared kind of just standing on a bridge, looking down into the abyss initially, little like around Christmas time, and then as the new year started, she became a little more aggressive and would sort of confront women who were walking on the street late at night and just stare at them. And then, you know, the women would flee. There were times she was actually said to, you know, to be violent, depending on the source you're reading. It got tied into, you know, there were theories as to it was a different, you know, it might have been this particular person who was a prankster, or police are mobilized. They, you know, there are people out there, vigilante gangs. There's a story that was kind of chilling but funny, where a mother saw her two children about to leave the house, and one I think is carrying an axe, and the other has like a knife or something. And she's like, "Where are you going?" And they're like, "Oh, we're going out to find the Greenville ghost." You know, so it's like, "Okay, kids, have fun." You know, because there were these, you know, like these, and again, these are tropes you come across not just with the black ghost, but some of these other characters I examine in the book. Mm. That, you know, they were out trying to find this character, groups of people, and there were, you know, reports sometimes that they'd find them, but then nobody could catch them. And, you know, it was always that, like, there's this element of always being out of reach.
Yes.
You know, and I know you did a couple episodes recently on Spring Hill Jack, which I love those tales. And I think this is kind of in the same lineage, so to speak.
Absolutely. I'm just going to read a section from some of the Greenville's antics, because this bit made me chuckle.
Yeah.
So she's obviously come across a young lady and terrified her. And you write, "The stunned girl regained her voice and let out a piercing shriek, causing the ghost to hurry away towards the Newark and New York Railroad. A young man ran to the girl's aid, and hearing what had happened, ran off in pursuit of the black-clad figure. Catching up, the courageous young man grabbed the ghost by its arm. Quietly, the ghost turned and delivered a stiff punch beneath the man's left ear, knocking him senseless to the ground. When the rescuer recovered, the ghost was gone."
I love hearing my words in your voice. If I do an audiobook, I should hire you.
I'd be honored and pleased. But it seemed everybody, it's one of those that there clearly was something happening.
I mean, even if, you know, it sort of follows, there's a book that I cite called Phantom Assailants.
Yes.
Brian Regal's one of the authors, a great author, you know, great, great book. You see a similar progression in a lot of these cases of what they call phantom assailants. And this is one of those where initially, like, the police seem to be taking this very seriously. There are many, and we're not just talking, like, you come across many one-off reports in old newspapers of strange things. Most of the cases that I'm looking into, I mean, it's like months and, you know, of multiple news stories reporting on this. So in different newspapers. So yes, the police were taking it seriously. They were looking into it, you know, but then, as you get toward the end of it, they start to question whether it's real. Sometimes they say, "Oh, we think it was this person. We warned them to stop, but it might have continued after that." So yeah, it really does. I think it seems like there was something going on, but there's just this stew of, I'm sure that, you know, there's this stew of like mass hysteria that plays into it and exaggeration as well. But I do think there was some kind of assailant there at the heart of it, is what it seems.
Mm. Well, you always get people sticking their oar in, Kevin, adding to the mystery of something. I mean, I was rewatching Jaws for the umpteenth time last week.
Oh yeah. There's a new, were you watching the newly remastered version of it? I got to check that out.
I am. I can't wait to see that on the IMAX and be taken to a whole new level of terror through seeing the 500-foot Bruce coming at me.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a prime example, because you've got kids in that film pretending to be a shark just for the laugh and popping on the surface and being faced by a boatload of men with guns.
Yeah. They're always and then I think, you know, copycats, but also, you know, just other, you know, other troublemakers out at night probably get lumped into it.
Mm.
I feel like the case study for me was the drone sightings in New Jersey late last year. That was, you know, that was the closest I can relate to, like, these type of stories that I've experienced. So everybody in New Jersey was talking about these drones are out at night everywhere, you know? And so there was one night where my wife and I went out looking for them. And, you know, at the time I was, there they are, you know, and I'm trying to film and, you know, it's, you're seeing them here and you're seeing them there. And then only later on did I say, wait a minute, it's very likely that some of what I saw were just airplanes. There was probably a reality to it as well. But I think, you know, it's just, you get caught up in the moment if you expect to see something, you're more likely to see it or interpret it that way. So, you know, so that definitely these old cases definitely remind me of, you know, of things that still happen today.
Mm. I mean, you still get them, I suppose. Like you say, I think mass hysteria is often the easiest excuse when you've got a strange thing going on that seems to be involving. And like you say,
I think it's more like a component.
Yes.
I think it's a component of it. I don't, you see people just dismiss it saying mass hysteria, but no, I think I think it's sometimes just a mechanism, maybe exaggeration to some of it, but it seems like there's often some truth there that maybe started it or is continuing to scare people.
Absolutely. I mean, you only have to look at what the Glasgow vampires story is a prime example of mass hysteria.
Oh, I was just reading about that the other day. That's a wild tale.
Absolutely. All the vampires in Highgate Cemetery in the 70s, you know? I mean, this is Britain in the 20th century, and you've got gangs of people running around London and Glasgow looking for vampires.
And it became so much more about, like, there were the two guys whose name escaped me right now, but one was like a sort of a traditional vampire hunter, and one was more of a psychic or, you know, was into like the psychic manifestation, and they were at odds. And it's a real case. I want to find a good book on that.
Yes, absolutely. David Ferrant was the magic one, and the Reverend Sean Manchester was the vampire hunter.
Thank you.
That's all right. It's a story very close to my heart. I do like, because it's balmy. Absolutely bam. And I don't think there's much to it, but it's great. It's a great story. I mean, there is weird stuff going on, like 600 people turning up bearing torches and forks and knives after they appeared on the news talking about a vampire running about Highgate, and the police couldn't deal with it. And
the mobs. Yeah. The mobs always seem to be an issue.
Doesn't take much to get people out here in the UK.
No.
Show them a vampire, Kevin. There's tons of people fancy their chances. But most of them got scared off because they saw something weird and they all got terrified and ran away. So it just shows you that even fear is contagious.
It could be one of those eternal lights goes on or something, you know, and something in that sort of heightened situation sometimes, you know, I think the slightest stimulus can set everybody across. Mm.
I suppose as well, you could always prescribe that the woman in black is often used as a sort of metaphor of loss. And obviously it used to be quite the tradition, both here and in America, for a widow to wear black for weeks, months, even years. I mean, Queen Victoria is probably the prime example that after Prince Albert died, she never wore any other colour but black, I believe, for the vast majority of her life, several decades. And so it always became almost a cliche for mourning. And so maybe it was in a way to try and break away from that, because you've also got to comprehend with the, why should somebody, yes, I know it's terrible that you've lost someone, but life moves on, it would seem. And we often hear stories of people who lose partners in tragic circumstances who then remarry. But this often seems to play into that kind of forever in mourning and never shall I move on.
There's definitely especially if it's ghostly, there's this eternal sense of loss. You know, there's definitely this sadness and, you know, that somber tragedy there that I think is implied by that. And also, I think it would be culturally that it was a staple. So if you did have criminals or people trying to, you know, just disguise themselves, that was a way that was like socially, it was a normal thing to see widows like that. So that, you know, it wouldn't be odd to see one initially, just, you know, somebody out with a veil and dressed all in black.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Strange things falling from the sky, Kevin, is a modern thing these days. I mean, you've got people all over the world claiming that there's weird balls of metal lying in the Pacific, and there's a very famous story. I'm trying to think about that ball. Was it in Florida that ended up, it became a great big mystery and nobody understood it, and then it all turned out it had fallen off a wagon driving on a bad road, and it was just some kind of...
Like the sphere?
Yes.
Like that. Is that the one? It was like a metal sphere?
Yes, that one.
There have been multiple stories like that, but yeah.
But you've got this incredible story about the Flaming Hand meteor, which I'd never come across before.
Yeah, that was that was just another one. I have to plug Odd Old News. Mm. He has a Substack, and he's also on social media, but he finds a lot of these. I think that might have been one that he found first. And, you know, it intrigued me. And so he and I just started looking together, and, you know, and then I just found like this whole, as I do, I found this whole saga, you know, behind it. I mean, well, I guess I'm going to be working on this for a couple of months. The story behind it, behind this flaming hand from space, there was a real like tragedy behind it. It was about a family that lost a teenage son, and had a lot, you know, it took them a long time to let that go or to move on. And not helping was the fact that not long after he died, this meteor struck the farm right where this kid used to spend a lot of his time working, and it looked just like a gnarled, petrified hand. It became, what does this hand signify? Some people thought it was pointing a finger.
Yes.
It was pointing a finger at blame at the doctors who failed him because he died of pneumonia. Or, as his sister said, was he trying to lend a helping hand to help, you know, because, you know, you need help on the farm, but he wants us to get past it. So, and because this was near Atlantic City, it of course became a major boardwalk attraction in the early 1900s,
yeah.
which had sort of this weird glitz and show business to it as well.
Well, this is the thing. We've got photos of it. It happened. This isn't a tall tale in a newspaper, Kevin. This is an object from outer space that crash landed on a farm. And like you say, what did it symbolize? Well, it certainly helped the family because they made money from it, because they allowed people to use it and got paid for them being the custodians of it, and allowed the local showman to have it as one of their attractions.
Yeah, for a season on the boardwalk. And then the father ended up working there as part of the attraction, like telling the story. So they profited somewhat from it, which they needed. Like, they didn't have enough money to buy the son a proper headstone. I wish the article stated whether they were able to do that, but I like to imagine that they might have. But the family, especially the mother, they were really rocked by this death, and it ended up just sort of continuing on in courtroom battles for the next couple of years. And tied into this was weird stuff, like of the hand being cursed, like on the spot where the meteor fell. The neighbor shot the father of the boy who died. They shot his dog. And so he took the neighbor to court saying, "This was my prized dog you killed." And the neighbor said, it wasn't worth the bullet the lead it took to shoot him, because he was eating all my chickens. And so the family lost this case. Then they sued the doctor in two different times, saying that he didn't give the proper attention to their son. And so it just dragged on and on and on. And, you know, eventually, throughout all of this, it keeps mentioning this like cursed, this flaming hand that was sort of, at the basis of all this. So, but eventually it settled down, and you can see that years later, that couple they still had all their other children. They had grandchildren. They were celebrating their anniversary. I don't know what became of the flaming hand, but as you said, there are pictures of it, and there are theories as to, like, if it was a meteor, if it was in the book, I have all like the scientific terms, which, you know, I don't remember. But it's like there's also a situation where like lightning strikes the ground and solidifies.
Yes.
Some of the material, so that it could have been that. It does look like it does look kind of like the hand of some alien creature. And then, of course, later on, you have the flaming skull that fell from space elsewhere.
Absolutely. And as you tease in the book, it's almost a sequel, Kevin.
Yeah, I it's just a fun thought. But I am imagining this alien explorer that orbiting Earth forever, something happened up there, and slowly his petrified body parts are raining down onto the planet. but when you read about the flaming skull, which fell several years later in California, the man who found it, that was his theory. Like, it, and unfortunately, there apparently were pictures of the skull, but they were not printed anywhere that I can find.
Mm.
But there was a reporter who saw them and confirmed it. But the finder of the skull, like, there was another meteor that found, and he was determined that it was going to be the body of this whatever it was, a visitor. Well, he said it was a visitor from another world. So, I don't know, but it's a fun thought to see what kind of anything can come from around us in the great expanse of the cosmos, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, space junk itself these days drops out with the terrifying regularity, and I think it's more luck than anything that we haven't had a severe catastrophe. Because I mean, one of the things that people often look, as we do this, the Perseids shower is about to hit its maximum.
Yeah,
I've been
this week,
fortunate to see a couple last month, and I've been aware of it for 20 years, Kevin. It still makes my mouth drop open like a small child when I see one. It's a remarkable thing. But they are, depending on how big they are, quite life-threatening. You only have to look at what happened in Chernobylsk in Russia. What was that, 10, 11 years ago? I mean, that even hit. And 1,500 people got injured because of the sound wave blowing everything up.
Buildings, windows shattered, structural damage. And yeah, we kind of live in purposeful ignorance, I think, go through our days and not worrying about what's going to drop down on us.
Absolutely. Well, I think there was something like 73 a day hitters. And most of them just burn up, but it's just the odd one or two that get through, like Chernobyl.
Or they hit the ocean, drop into the ocean or somewhere, that's uninhabited.
Well, it's like that. If a tree falls down in the wood and nobody sees it, Kevin, does it make a noise? If a meteor lands in the sea, does anybody hear it? It's one of those things. I would imagine the bottom of the sea is dotted with them, which is quite a good part of the fact that the planet's covered in nearly 70% of its water. So most of them are going to land there. But it is... I mean, obviously, it's a whole business. So I hope it must still be out there somewhere. It's probably in a box, in a lockup somewhere, you would imagine.
I would like to look. It's one of those things that's in the back of my mind because I'm in New Jersey, and this is a New Jersey story. I've had it in my mind to try to see if I could track it down. For all we know, it got buried with one of the family members or something, but not necessarily. Mm. It might still be in it could be in a museum or something like that. Or just in somebody's attic. Mm. But, I think it's the chance of, a meteor, falling in the exact spot, and then it immediately shakes up the lives of the people who find it. It's just, I don't know. There is something definitely cosmic about this.
They certainly needed it to land for whatever reason, like you say, and then off they went. That was it. Maybe it gave them the money to make daft legal decisions, Kevin. That's probably its gift.
I'm hoping that's another thing. I want to see. There's a mention of where the sun was buried. I'm curious if that cemetery, it's probably still there. I'm curious if there's a stone or not. If there's a monument.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting if we can locate it, if it really is, because we could put it to bed really and find out where it came from. Was it a meteor? Because we...
I'm sure today, if it still exists, scientists can look at it and give us an idea. Of course, do you want to dispel the mystery totally? I don't know. But I would like to. I would like. It is. It is a question mark. Yeah.
Because I think as well. I mean, it's big business these days, Kevin. I mean, that's the thing about meteors is once you discover that people make a lot of money, people run around the world whenever there has been one sighted, run around. They go for millions. Some of them.
Mm. That's true. Somebody may not even know what they have, passed down from generations.
Absolutely. I mean, was it? What was her name? Is it Anne Hodges, the lady that was laid on a bed not feeling well and a meteor came through a roof and hit her?
I think I've heard that. I don't know if that was the name, but I've heard
And it made her life. I think she was offered something like £20,000 for it in the 1950s, and she said no chance. But it's one of those weird stories that she survived because she was ill, and she was laid on the settee with about six eiderdowns over her to keep her warm, and they think that's what stopped her getting seriously hurt.
Wow.
So she was lucky enough to be ill when it happened, because if she hadn't been, she'd have been killed.
I'm looking up my screen right now.
But she became something like a celebrity. She would go on those kind of game shows where you'd have to guess why this person's famous.
Okay.
And there is footage of her doing all that sort of stuff in the mid-50s. Oh. So if you look for her, you can find some of these brilliant stuff. And it's amazing. There's one woman who goes, "You're that lady that nearly got killed by a meteor, aren't you?" I'm like, what? How does she know this? It's great to see, because it's a crazy story anyway.
There's those old, I've noticed there are a lot of those old game show or, just old talk show segments online like that. Like there's one with, it's probably from the 50s, but there was a guy who was a little kid and he was there when Abraham Lincoln got shot at Ford's Theater. It's wow. That's
yeah.
reminds you the past doesn't seem as far away when you see it on television.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. People saying, yeah, I was at Jesse James's funeral or and things like that. What? Hang on. That seems like a million years ago. But you're on telly. What are you talking about, mate? Brilliant. I mean, it's a great story on whatever level. But, I mean, one of the great things about your book especially is the amount of these stories that I've either seem to have been overlooked or forgotten or pushed to one side or have just fallen out of favour. Because I think sometimes one of the biggest problems in the Fortean world is we know these stories and there's lots of them that keep coming back round all in all, over and over and over again, Kevin.
There's a lot of recycling, you know, and I try to avoid, not that I don't appreciate, you know, people who keep these stories alive, but if I'm going to look into some, like for example, one that's a more well-known story, I'm going to try to find some aspect of it that maybe hasn't been reported before, some new insight. But for the most part, yeah, I try. You know, it's wonderful coming across these tales that are just completely obscure, but you know, have you know, just some meat off of them that are just very interesting.
There's one I read, Kevin, that I'd never heard anything about at all, mm-hmm. on any level, which I don't understand, because if there's anything that gets my Fortean juices flowing, it's a werewolf dogman kind of story. And it's this brilliant one about the monster of Marmot Street. And you've got a delightfully creepy drawing to introduce this particular part of the book, of this jaw-opened monster just terrifying a young lady as she walks down the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried to evoke, you know, the way it's described, sort of that luminescence, you know, threat.
Absolutely. Is it a surprise when you stumble across stories like this? Because werewolf stories are something that a lot of people often, I mean, these days, it's, you can fall down a rabbit hole of dogman, man-dog, werewolf, what's the difference? Does it really matter? Why are we arguing about bipedal wolves running around the world terrifying people? They're not supposed to exist, whatever they are. This seems to be one of them that's been completely dropped. Because do you think this is because it happened in Alabama and not in one of the prescribed werewolf locations? You've got the Deep South and you've got the north of the US, which are probably more synonymous with werewolf, dogman, man-dog stories.
Well, don't forget that, you know, it, you know, Alabama is not too far from Louisiana, mm-hmm. which you have the French and the Creole and Loup Garou,
is
a part of that folklore. So it does, and that's even referenced in articles about the monster of Marmot Street. But it could also be the fact that the monster of Marmot Street was more or less solved, you know, that it kind of became more obscure. But I think that's a unique aspect to it. It's rare that you can take one of these cases and, you know, and there's a solution. And on one hand, that's disappointing. But then when I realized what the solution was, and that a certain animal that we don't think of as being dangerous really can be, and even in multiple cases. I don't know if we should spoil it or not, but we can if you'd like.
No, I don't want to spoil it. But yeah. I suppose it's one of those things about animals that in certain circumstances, I think most animals can kill you either by accident or design.
My cat could bite me and break the skin, and there's so much bacteria that you can get an infection and die. You know, it can happen.
Absolutely. I mean, even a scratch, not even a bite, can do it to certain people. And because everybody's different, certain people, it's one of those things. Exactly. Bees are the most inauspicious, you know, they're very just buzzy about, they do what they do. Yes, I know there's killer bees and wandering around, and that's not a good thing. And once again, well done.
We need them, you know.
Well, we do, exactly. Well done, people, for making killer bees even worse by making them aggressive and also brilliant at creating honey. Well done, everyone, and let's just forget what they did, because that's just one of the stupidest things I've ever heard behind introducing cane toads to Australia, Kevin. It's one of those things, until a bee stings you, you don't know if you're allergic to it or not. And I used to be terrified, because I didn't get stung by a bee or a wasp till I was into my early 30s. So I always had this fear at the back of my mind that maybe I would get an anaphylactic shock and I'd die. But then I got stung 6 times at the same time, and thought, and apart from being really annoyed because it was all on my head.
That hurts.
So I looked like I'd badly shaved my hair. It stopped hurting after about an hour, and I thought, well, I'm not going to die, which is all right. But the tiniest things can do that. So it's not surprising that panic can set in and people prescribe supernatural powers to fairly run-of-the-mill animals at the end of the day.
And it's just, I think these nighttime scary encounters, things happen quickly. And then, you know, news gets around and suddenly there's a monster. I'd like to think that maybe the solution wasn't the real one and there was actually a real monster, but you don't hear, there was nothing about it that I saw after the monster was killed. So.
It's one of those perplexing cases. I'm trying to think what it was, but there was a werewolf flap somewhere in the 70s, Kevin, that was really well reported and it was smashing things up and chasing people about. And within a few years, nobody in the town wanted to talk about it anymore. It was like, no, we don't want to talk about that summer of the werewolf or whatever it was. And I always forget where it is. It pops into my head. I always think, I'm going to dig into that and look for it. And then I never do.
Yeah, I'm sure I'd be curious.
But the monster of Marmot Street actually led you to the next character I want to dive into before I let you go, which is this incredible story of the Gown Man. And as you say in the book, this seems to be one of the forgotten ghosts of North America. It seemed to be massive, terrifying people.
It really was major, and we're in it over decades. You know, there this character or similar characters were reported across the American South. So in the Monster of Marmot Street, which was in the 30s, there is a line in one of the articles that said, "Not since the Gown Man terrorized Mobile, Alabama." I'm like, "What the heck is the Gown Man?" Right. There goes the rabbit hole opening up into like a cavern beneath my feet. but I was thankful because it was really fascinating. So the Gown Man was sort of like we talk about phantom assailants, phantom attackers. It was this characters that were not necessarily dressed in women's clothing, but wore obscuring gowns. And would assault people or terrify people, you know, on the streets at night. And it was across many states, many towns, again, over the course of decades. And then I began to realize there were other names for it. When you go back further, right, there was, and so there seemed to be, it seems like it was the same thing. It was called Hugging Molly, which is, Hugging Molly sounds like a ska band or something. Hugging Molly. But and that goes back even further. And then you see that it's connected in some degree to the woman in black. Mm. Only the woman in black, even though there are, you see some woman in black cases in the South, they're mostly in the northern states. The South, and as I learned very specifically, like in black communities is where this Gown Man seemed to originate, kind of like a, as I point out in the book, it's kind of like a Candyman situation where, you know, maybe there's some aspect of this tied into trauma. We have to remember this is the late 1800s and the early 1900s, Civil War and emancipation were within living memory.
Yes.
So, and you also had the rise of the KKK, you know, and there was some speculation that some of these gown men could be related to the KKK.
Yeah.
But the weird part was that when occasionally one was captured, it was generally it was the black man, like within their own community.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was just like prank. Some of them were pranks. Some of these people were pranksters, like going boo, you know. Yes. But others, you know, they were said to chase and rob people and so forth. And there were reports of this going all the way through. There was back in like. I guess it was a function. It was a function of the New Deal. There were national writers' projects in like the 1940s, and there were a lot of. They're very, very useful. Like there were a lot of states. There were they had writers that collect folklore, like go out into the field and collect folklore from people. And you see there are Gown Man stories within this time period, especially in New Orleans. And by this point. Going, tying this back into Phantom Automobiles, the Gown Man now had a car. He had a long black automobile that he would drive around the levees with, and you know, and would terrify, usually terrify women. And I think one of the line would make them fear for their virtues. but it was like this, just these cloaked mystery men, you know, and There is some aspect of it, especially when they were called Hugging Mollies. They were more like in dresses. Mm. This is one of those things where I was sharing this information and someone pointed out that in England, in like, I think it was like going back to the 1700s, Molly was a pejorative term for effeminate gay men.
Yeah, it was.
And there were Molly houses, which were gathering places where they could be together in secret, just, you know, to be who they were without being persecuted. And, you know, there were laws against cross-dressing in the United States in, you know, back in England during that time, it could be the death penalty. I mean, it was, you were really risking to have any kind of public expression of your identity. You know, you could really be risking your life, you know, your freedom. So I think that's sort of like, there was a distrust even, you know, during this period of like men dressing in women's clothing and things like that. So that plays into it, not always on the surface. Mm-hmm. But it is there. But a lot of the, you know, in a lot of these cases, though, it was like these just sort of these fearsome nighttime entities that, and then sometimes they would take on a supernatural level. The best one being that's still celebrated today in Abbeville, Alabama. They have Hugging Molly as their town mascot. And that version of Hugging Molly was a tall, muscular figure dressed like the woman in black, like in a veil, that would accost people walking on the street at night. Never hurt anybody, but would like grab them and scream in their ears, you know, like, you know, fearsome. But, you know, if you can actually, there's a picture in my book of like the town sign, it shows a silhouette of like Hugging Molly chasing somebody. I think it's great that the town has like fully embraced this history. But when you actually look at some of the reports, there was a point where in one area, Hugging Molly took on, it was said to be like a hand reaching out of the sore and like these hairy hands. And I'm thinking, you know, like some combination of the hairy hands of Dartmoor and like Pennywise the clown, you know, like, so like, you know, you see that these exaggerate, they become these exaggerated phantoms. But there's just such this long and storied history there. And it's been forgotten for the most part, you know, and I'm sure there are plenty of other cases out there like that, where in my feeling, you know, even with some of the maybe the troublesome aspects to the history of it, I still think it deserves to be celebrated. It's part of our story. It's part of our folklore and probably even part of our history, because there's probably some truth to a lot of the cases.
Absolutely. And I think, like you say in the book, you've got to understand the time when some of these stories were reported. You've got to understand the language that's used. And I think for some people who look at the world through a modern prism, Kevin, sometimes they can look at some of these old stories and be quite shocked by the language used. And I often find that peculiar, because I don't understand why they wouldn't think that's how people used those terms in those days. It wasn't like it. There's a reason what happened in the 1960s happened, guys. You know, how well do you know your history? And so the gown man, like you say, is such a strange thing, because you've got so many ingredients going on. Like you say, you've got people saying, oh, well, it's the KKK just trying to frighten people, trying to keep them under the cosh, as it were, showing them who's boss.
And it just coincides with the emergence, right?
Yes.
You see somebody in a gown, and I believe in one particular case, they even talk about like a pointed like hood or a hat or something. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, and like going into the woods, I'm picturing like, and oh brother, where art thou? Where they stumble upon, you know, the big like fiery ceremony, yes, in the woods, you know. But you read in the contemporary article, it's talking about it like, oh, it's never hurt anybody, and you know, it's just like there are like these like conflicting feelings about it. It's like, I don't know, you know, it's such a mixture, as you're saying, of influences, I think. And what is it? Does it represent? Is it sort of a way of, is some of it a way of like processing certain fears?
Yes.
You know, you can write, you know, I'm sure you can write a whole book just on that. But
mm. I mean, the other thing that makes me chat is some of the culprits that were caught were pretty crap. I mean, there's yeah, one guy, and I think his surname's Coleman, whose trick was he used to just run up, put his coat over his head and just go, ooh. And you just think, yeah, right. Why would that like scare anybody? What's going on?
You know, I feel like the threat was more in the anticipation. Yes. You know, it was just the old, you know, fear being out at night, and you're also talking in, you know, I think it's a time of increasing urbanization mm-hmm. in the States. It tends to happen more in you know, areas that are becoming more city-like, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like being afraid of a mugger, but in this case, the muggers are in costume, you know, and sometimes have supernatural abilities.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you occasionally get those weird stories of people dressed up as famous cartoon characters or whatever, committing crimes yeah. or whatever.
Oh, well, like the clowns.
Well,
back.
Yes, everybody it was everywhere. The phantom clowns appearing from all over the place. Mm-hmm. And that just saw so many hoaxes pop up. Like, you'd see videos of people driving through really quiet parts of Sheffield where you could hide somebody dressed as a clown and go, oh, look, there's somebody walking through this industrial estate. Why would they be there? The chances of you seeing a car at 11 o'clock at night in an area that's shut 6 hours ago, Kevin, as soon as you see that, you go, that's a little bit too good to be true. But then you get all these, you get the stories about the certain van that they drive, and kids all need to be aware and watching out for Coco the clown. It's crazy.
It's, you know, it reminds me of like razor blades and apples on Halloween, you know, it becomes like fact. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's so often repeated. But I just wanted to, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, you're talking about sort of the difficulty sometimes in talking about these things. Mm. And I struggle with that. And I even talk about that in the book. It's like, you know, anytime you get into, you know, the more problematic areas of our, you know, of our past, even like when I first posted about my findings about like the hugging mollies, you know, like I was accused, they were like, oh, I think this is like, it was like gay bashing or something like that. And I'm like, no. And they thought I was making it up. And I'm like, no, here are my list of sources. You know, this is just like this was a real phenomenon, whatever it was. Mm. And however you interpret it, it's something that happened. It's something that was reported on. And I think it's worth examining. Mm,
absolutely. I mean, there'd be a lot of people who wouldn't read a book made before 1984, I think, Kevin, if they understood, you know, some of the dreadful language that was used in all kinds of aspects.
I omit things. I have to, you know, like I struggle with it, you know, like even in listing sometimes the headlines
yes.
of the news articles, I even occasionally will blank out certain words because I'm like, I mean, you can use your imagination, some of the things they said. You know, even, you know, there are terms that were even grossly offensive back then. There were terms that were just the terms they used back then that today are considered offensive.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. Some of the greatest works of literature have very problematic language in them. I mean, I remember the first time I remember reading it as a switched-on adult, and I reread the complete works of Sherlock Holmes, Kevin. Oh, yeah. And there's several things in there that make you go, ooh. But then I have to balance it up and think, well, when was it written? And it was written 140 years ago. And therefore, yes, it's distasteful, and I don't like the terms. But that's what it was in those days. Doesn't make it right, but that's just how it is. And we can't, sometimes we throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
And you have to look at it overall. And Sherlock Holmes is a prime example. There are very few challenging pieces of language, but there are there. And they talk about people from China, people from Africa, mm-hmm. people from Ireland. There are usually distasteful terms used about those particular people by characters. But that's how those people would have spoken about them, sadly. That's how it is. It's not like you get the situation these days where you get people sort of, as you say, pushing forward narratives to marginalise people. And this is just how it was. And I remember when I spoke with Adam Benedict, who's done a couple of books about historical ghosts and monsters, he had to put warnings at the beginning of the books because he's printed them unabridged. He's not taken any of the language out.
Yeah.
Wow. And I think even for somebody who doesn't live in the States, I understand exactly what he was referring to there. But I think you've got to understand your history. You can't ignore it, because if you ignore it, that's just not solving the problem at all. I think
sanitize it. I don't think you're doing anyone any favors, because, you know, I mean, because think about things today that you might not consider or thoughtless or offensive, right? So I think sometimes seeing an example of it from the past can make you go, oh, you know, maybe I should rethink how I approach this. But I think the current generation tends to think we're the most enlightened. You know, people that have ever existed.
Oh, yes. Oh, don't we just. And then you look through history and realize, well, people were a bit cleverer than we were 3,000 years ago, and then somebody turned up and ruined it.
Yeah,
somebody turned up and ballsed it all up for everyone. I suppose before I let you leave, Kevin, was there any facet of this particular collection that you were stunned by, made you thirsty to try and find more similar stories, or a whole genre of this wonderful subject that you had never really come across? I know we touched on the Gowned Man and the Hugging Mollies, which, to be fair, I hadn't heard of either of them, though I knew the term, especially how it was used as a term of insult.
So you were already aware of that. That's interesting, because, I'd never heard that. So that was, it was news to me, but, so I was glad to, it's one of the things where it's kind of like, I feel like, in a way, I call it in my head crowdsourcing, that sometimes, like, when I write, like, the first versions of my articles, often, like, post them on Reddit and places, and it's great because, you know, there, people will, when they do comment, you know, will sometimes share really helpful perspectives that help me improve the final product, you know, that I put in the book. Mm. You know, like, I'm glad that I did that, because otherwise, you know, maybe I would have thought to look at it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, but to be able to, like, make that connection as to why that term was being used at that point in time, because it's not spelled out, you know, when you go back and look at those sources.
Absolutely.
But isn't in terms of what surprised, well, I'll tell you this. And this is sort of a plug, but originally, one of the centerpieces of this book was going to be a chapter that I ended up taking out, and I'm writing it into its own book because there was so much material, and it wasn't just in America, it was across the world, and that was the topic of man-eating plants.
Yes.
So everyone in this who's into this kind of thing, I was well aware of the story of the man-eating tree of Madagascar and the vampire vine of Nicaragua. What I didn't realize was just how many stories there are like that, you know, and across the world. And so that ended up, I ended up saying there's enough material here for a third book, my third book. So that's good. That'll be the next. So that's another situation where you learn some things. Like, there are some real, not maybe plants that eat people, but plants that are dangerous, that you do learn some base. There is some basis, in fact. And you also learn that some of those famous authors like Arthur Conan Doyle wrote some of the fictional stories. Then you realize this was a big genre, you know, when the sort of that turn of the century, 19th to 20th century. So, yeah, so that was fun.
Yeah. Well, it's all wrapped up in that kind of boy's own adventure world, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sort of like these stories, those particular, you know, stories, they sort of have that like great white hunter, aspect to them,
yeah.
You know, the pith helmets and going off into the jungle and the natives and worshiping mystery. It's this whole like, yeah, it's like that whole sort of like Jules Verne or something, like, you know, Mysterious Island. But anytime you look into these stories, it kind of reveals what was going on at the time, why it was popular. And then you find little incongruent bits of truth. And you're like, I thought this was all fake, but then some of the people saying this are actually pretty reputable. So what's going on? Are they just telling stories, or could there have been some truth there?
Well, the thing is as well, you've got a foot in both camps, because we know there are carnivorous plants. We know there are.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. Charles Darwin investigated them for, like, I think it was 16 or 18 years of his career, and then wrote a book on it, which, you know, it's, and he was impressed with the fact, you know, and he wrote this in his, I think in his own, I don't know if it was in his book about it, but I think he wrote it in his letters. He said, you know, he was just really gobsmacked by the fact, he didn't use that word. He's gobsmacked by the fact that the processes in plants that digest, you know, the enzymes that digest prey function very similar to the stomach in animals. Just seeing how, you know, they adapted, like essentially saying that, you know, maybe plants and animals aren't as different as we like to think.
Absolutely. And it doesn't take a massive leap of faith to go from a Venus flytrap to a man-eating plant in the middle of Africa in 1900s.
Right. You know, you think in prehistoric times, could there have been larger plants that ate larger animals? There's not any evidence of that. There are remnants of, like, I think pitcher plants, but I don't think they were any larger than the ones we have today. Mm. You know, and it's disputed if that's what, cause, you know, like the little bits they had, that's what it was, but. You know, but yeah, you think like off, you know, in some unexplored jungle, you know, is there there's a story in recent years that says there's one even in New Jersey in the Pine Barrens, not far from where I live. So if I ever disappear one day, you know, check the plans.
Well, you've only got to, I mean, as we talk about the 40th, you have to wonder what the first person who saw a Venus flytrap eat a fly think. Mm-hmm. And yeah. That must have just blown their mind. There must be, hang on a minute, what's happening here?
Like you know, it's like, what's going on? Yeah, it's, and you know, in the Venus flytrap, I mean, it's only found in nature, in this like little area in the Carolinas.
Yeah. Is it next to a meteor crater, is it?
So there are these structures. They're sort of like shallow depressions. They're called the Carolina Bays. Yeah. They're not just in the Carolinas, yes. Though. They're like across part of the East Coast. There was a thought at one time that they might have been caused by meteorite impacts. I think that seems to be disputed today, that that's what it is. But the Venus flytrap is endemic in the Carolinas to those like Carolina Bays. So yeah, there was a sort of a theory that, gee, maybe the Venus flytrap came from space, mm-hmm. much like the Mean Green Mother from outer space,
yeah.
Aldrey too.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably came on a meteor that brought the octopus with it as well, I suspect.
Exactly.
Because I don't believe that they are the best example of an alien creature.
They're amazing.
So yeah, maybe that's why the Venus flytraps have stayed on land, Kevin, because they're enemies. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go near where the octopi are. They're terrified.
Maybe they're naturally right. They're natural enemies on their pie.
Brad, even that bit just makes me fascinated that the Venus flytrap only grows in the world in that area, which is incredible.
Yeah, because then you look at some of the other like carnivorous plants, like the sundews and pitcher plants, and they're found across a wider part of the planet.
Yes.
You know, it's like it might be tropical, but you know, but they're all on different islands. But yeah, the Venus flytrap is very contained to just that one region of the United States.
Fascinating. Well, listen, I could keep you here forever, buddy. But...
Oh, I could talk forever.
So, Kevin, before we dive in and let everybody know where they can find this wonderful new collection of stories, obviously, you've got this project about man-eating plants coming together. Another Day of the Triffids, one would suggest. What else is in the... Irons are in the fire for you, my friend. Is there another volume of strangeness developing as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, I have enough research and material to easily put out a third book. I didn't write it yet, but that's definitely, you know, and I published early versions of them on my blog, which is AmericanStrangeness.com. And I've been talking for like 5 years now about writing a book about the missing Thunderbird photo, and I am writing it in the background, and that's, I plan to get that done after this man-eating plants book, because that's involved the most like journalistic research, like visiting locations and libraries and interviewing people, some who are unfortunately have passed away in the years since I spoke with them, but you know, trying to this all began with the missing Thunderbird photo. I've always been interested in these topics, but that was the one that got me really actively investigating it. And it was because here was a tale that there was clearly more to it. There were clearly paths that hadn't been explored, you know? And so I'm like, well, let's chase it a bit. Let's see where it goes. And in that case, while I'd love to be able to say, yeah, I found this missing photo, the story I found behind it at least supports the fact that it feels like there's something there. And, you know, it's interesting just to see how this evolves, right, you know, over a long period of time. And it ties into so many other beliefs and 40 and stories. So, and that's sort of what I've brought to, you know, all the stories in American Strangeness, which is just, I just love the investigation aspect of it, you know, digging into these older tales, you know, that just because, you know, there's so much information out there that, you know, I think that hasn't been combed over yet, and these stories deserve to be brought back to life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And all power to you. So I look forward to numerous books from you then coming soon. Well,
thank
Kevin.
You. I keep writing.
And I'll keep reading. So, my friend, where can everybody get your books? Follow you online, keep up to date, and all your fabulous blog posts that you spoil us with occasionally?
Yes. Well, of course, American Strangeness, but my books are all on Amazon, easy to get, either in paperback or very, very reasonably priced Kindle versions.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes as always. Kevin, thank you again for making time. It's always a pleasure to both read your book and speak to you about some of the subjects and scary characters you've uncovered from the past for our enjoyment, my friend. And I wish you all the very best, sir.
Very welcome, Paul. I hope you're not scared. I hope I didn't scare anybody to go outside walking at night.
Depends where you live.
Yep.
Take care.
Take care, Paul. Bye.